Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, giving the first ever presidential radio fireside chat to the nation.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking.
It's Sunday, March the 12th, 1933. FDR has been in the White House for a week and a day, and the Great Depression has taken a turn for the worse. The previous Thursday, FDR had begun his seminal New Deal legislative push. At the top of the agenda for fighting the Depression, the Emergency Banking Act.
I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days, and why it was done, and what the next steps are going to be. I recognize that the many proclamations from state capitals and from Washington, the legislation, the Treasury regulations, and so forth, couched for the most part in banking and legal terms, ought to be explained for the benefit of the average citizen.
Explained for the benefit of the average citizen. My name is Alexander Badgett. This is the Bankster Podcast, Season 3, Last Resort, presented by CentralVerse.org. Today, Episode 3, The Great Depression.
Closing time. The close of an era. The great big spree, the jazz age, is over. All over. In the 1920s, the great American word was prosperity. Now the 30s have begun and there is a new word, depression.
The Great Depression was long and devastating. Here's Ben Bernanke, former chair of the Federal Reserve, discussing one aspect of the system-wide failure.
About a third of all the banks, thousands of banks in the United States, failed. They collapsed, they went bankrupt.
The banking system is a critical part of the economy, and when it trembles, the shockwaves are felt in every other industry, felt most critically in every neighborhood and by every family. Here are a few more staggering statistics about the Great Depression from Liaquat Ahmed's audiobook Lords of Finance.
The currency and banking convulsions of 1931 changed the nature of the economic collapse. As prices fell and businesses were unable to service their debts, bankruptcies proliferated, further chilling spending and economic activity. A corrosive deflationary psychology set in. Fearing that prices would fall further, consumers and businesses cut spending, adding to the downward spiral in consumption and investment. Every economic indicator seemed to fall off a cliff. 1932 was the deepest year of depression in the United States. Between September 1931 and June 1932, production fell 25%, investment dived a stunning 50%, and prices dropped another 10%, reaching 75% of their 1929 level. Unemployment shot up beyond 10 million. More than 20% of the workforce was now without jobs. American corporations, which had made almost $10 billion in profits in 1929, collectively lost $3 billion in 1932.
Before we dive into the Federal Reserve's lending of last resort actions during this time period, there are three points I want to pause and emphasize. The first is that everything we're talking about on this podcast, and the reason the Fed exists to begin with, is to make people's lives better. They work with banks and huge sums of money, but unemployment is devastating. It affects not only individuals, but generations of families and entire communities. So please keep that in mind as we discuss these technocratic policy decisions. The second point is that the Fed didn't do a very good job during the Great Depression. One especially tough yet respected critique of the Fed's actions came from Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman.
It was produced, the Great Depression was produced by a failure of government, by a failure of monetary policy. It was produced by a failure of the Federal Reserve System to act in accordance with the intentions of those who established it.
The third point is that the federal government did provide loans via the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And we'll briefly mention this, but we're mainly sticking to the actions and inactions of the central bank. With these three points in mind, let's dive into the Federal Reserve's lending of last resort activities during the Great Depression. The traditional lending of last resort that the Fed has done, and in the following aspect still does today, is by issuing loans via something called the discount window. Now, in the time of the Depression, there really was a borrowing window, a physical window in each of the 12 Federal Reserve banks, a place where bankers could walk up to and either ask for a loan or pay one back. Today, there is no physical window. All the loans are done online or over the phone. In fact, when I worked at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, the folks manning the discount window sat just one row of cubes down from where I sat. Additionally, the word discount doesn't mean it's offered at a lower price. To the contrary, per Badgett's dictum, the interest rate charged on these last resort loans are higher than the regular market rate. The word discount actually refers to a special type of loan, one where the total amount you pay back, including interest, is the round title number. To illustrate, let's compare what a discount loan would look like versus a mortgage loan for your home. Let's say you go to the bank looking for a mortgage loan of $250,000 to build your first home. When the bank agrees to the loan, they add $250,000 to your account so you can pay the builder to build your home. That $250,000 is the round title number. But over the next 30 years, month by month, you're going to have to pay the bank back. Eventually, all of the $250,000 plus interest. So by the end of the 30 years, maybe you've paid the bank back $300,000 in total. That's how a regular loan would work. On the other hand, the bank could offer you the same amount of money via a different type of loan, a discount loan. The round title number on this discount loan would be $300,000. So you'd receive a $300,000 loan from the bank. However, the bank would only deposit $250,000 in your account. Then, over the next 30 years, you'd pay the bank back all the way to the original $300,000. See, it's called a discount loan because the amount the bank initially delivers to you is less than the round headline number. It's okay if you didn't completely follow the logic of this discount loan. All you really need to remember is that a discount window loan is one given by the Federal Reserve to banks who can't get one from anywhere else. As I mentioned earlier, discount window loans are the traditional method by which the Fed provides last resort money to the banking system. By its own admission, here are some reasons the Fed failed to provide adequate last resort discount window lending during the Great Depression. I've dramatized the Fed's essay outlining their mistakes.
Our decision-making structure was decentralized and often ineffective.
See, each of the 12 districts had its own leadership who set policies for its own geography. We didn't have to coordinate.
Worse than not coordinating, sometimes we took completely contradictory courses of action.
We disagreed on not only specific policy decisions, but we had fundamentally different views about what the central bank should do in a crisis.
Some of us were up to speed on Badgett's rule and were ready to lend freely.
But many of us were not. Some of us believed the exact opposite, a theory called the real bills doctrine. This indicated that we should lend more only when things were growing, not during times of panic and contraction.
Some of us thought we should step completely to the side and let the banks fail, pruning the weak ones from the system.
Ultimately, our cross-district intellectual tensions and our ineffective decision-making structure made it difficult, and at times impossible, for us to take effective action.
With these errors in mind, it's worth noting that the Fed's arsenal of financial crisis fighting tools was not limited to the discount window alone. They could have made additional funds available via a different kind of emergency loan. These loans are often known by the section of the Federal Reserve Act that authorizes them, Section 13.3. Here's Ben Bernanke in his 2015 memoir introducing what a 13.3 loan is.
Congress had added Section 13.3 to the Federal Reserve Act in 1932, motivated by the evaporation of credit that followed the collapse of thousands of banks in the early 1930s. Section 13(3) gave the Federal Reserve the ability to lend to essentially any private borrower. At least five members of the board needed to certify that unusual and exigent circumstances prevailed in credit markets. The lending reserve bank also had to obtain evidence that other sources of credit were not available to the borrower.
Bernanke goes on to point out the limited use of 13(3) by the Fed during the Great Depression.
The Fed used its 13(3) authority during the Depression, but only sparingly. From 1932 to 1936, it made 123 such loans, mostly very small. The largest, $300,000, was made to a typewriter manufacturer. Another, for $250,000, was extended to a vegetable grower. As the economy and credit markets improved in the latter part of the 1930s, the Fed stopped making 13(3) loans.
The addition of Section 13(3) to the Federal Reserve Act came with significant potential. It could have drastically increased the Fed's ability to implement the lend freely principle of Bagehot's dictum. U.S. Senator Carter Glass, one of the most influential senators of the day and half the namesake of the famous Glass-Steagall Act, said of Section 13(3), quote, "Judiciously administered, it will prove both useful and profitable to the Federal Reserve System and to the businesses of the country," close quote. Unfortunately, in practice, it largely underwhelmed. For more details on the history of 13(3) and the Fed's failures during the Great Depression, we're going to turn to a fascinating paper written by Pari Sastry, at the time of the paper's publication, a senior research analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The language that would make up Section 13(3) actually made its first appearance in the Act in an earlier section, 10B. In February of 1932, the language in 10B was added as a temporary one-year authority to lend to member banks. It included two aspects that would become the pillars of Section 13(3). First, it qualified that the lending could only be done in exceptional and exigent circumstances. This underlines its purpose as a last resort emergency lending power, and not one that should be used day-to-day in regular operations. The second was the language stipulated that the loans had to be secured to the satisfaction of the Federal Reserve Bank. This refers to the on good collateral part of Bagehot's dictum. A few months later, on July 21, 1932, after consultations with the Fed, the language was transferred to Section 13(3), and an important aspect was added. The loans under Section 13(3) authority could be issued to, quote, any individual, partnership, or corporation, close quote. This significantly improved the Fed's ability to follow the lend freely part of Bagehot's dictum. The Federal Reserve clipped the new wings granted by 13(3) before they even had a chance to stretch them. They chose a narrow interpretation of what collateral would qualify, and still more detrimental, they decided that banks outside of the Fed system were not eligible for 13(3) lending, quote, even under significant pressure from Congress and the executive branch, close quote. So intense was their distaste for the idea that non-member banks would have access to Fed emergency funds that they went to the White House to tell the president. Quote, "In the board's view, the appropriate lender for non-member banks is the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, the institution created by Congress to provide targeted assistance to the financial system," close quote. Sastry goes so far as to say, "The board's exclusion of non-member banks in its interpretation of corporations under 13(3) implies that it did not view 13(3) as a lender of last resort authority." So in the end, the Federal Reserve underutilized both their traditional lender of last resort authority in the discount window and the new authority granted to them in Section 13(3). The Fed wouldn't use the unusual and exigent authorization again for 75 years. But boy, when they use it next, do they use it. A significant portion of the Fed's actions taken during the Great Recession were done under 13(3) authorization. I look forward to talking about that in a future episode of this season. But for now, we're going to finish this episode on the Great Depression by talking about a sister function to the lender of last resort. That is, deposit insurance. In 1931, a cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune published a political cartoon below the title, "A Wise Economist Asks a Question." A haggardly man is seen smoking a pipe while sitting on a park bench. A squirrel, who's the wise economist in the cartoon, approaches the man and asks, "But why didn't you save some for the future when times were good?" The squirrel is certainly thinking about the nuts she herself has buried. The man, a resigned look on his face, replies to the squirrel, "I did." His coat jacket, resting on the bench behind him, bears the caption, "Victim of bank failure." This cartoon would go on to win the Pulitzer Prize. It captured the hopelessness of those who, for no fault of their own, had lost their savings when their bank was caught up in the collapse of the financial system of the Great Depression. This doesn't happen today. Putting a deposit down at a bank in the early 20th century was less like putting it in a safety box and more like investing it in a startup. On any given day, there was no guarantee that you'd be able to withdraw all of your money. During the 1920s, there were an average of 600 bank failures a year, mostly in rural areas. Between 1930 and 1933, the average nearly tripled to 1,500 failures per year, and not just in rural areas, but also in the populous urban cities. In 1933, 4,000 banks failed. That was one in every five of the day, and over 20 times the amount of deposits were lost in that year than in the 20s. Banking panics are scary and destructive. They don't just affect the banks or people that had made poor decisions or gambled with their investments. The problems might begin at banks that had bad managers, but banking panics spread like wildfire, or like a deadly, contagious virus. The entire financial system is built on the foundation of trust. When that trust is lost, the system can quickly collapse in on itself, just like a building that's lost its foundation. One of FDR's key presidential advisors described it this way, quote, "We knew how much of banking depended upon make-believe, or, stated more conservatively, the vital part that public confidence had in assuring solvency." Close quote. The administration knew they needed to confront the issue head-on. They sought passage of the Emergency Banking Act.
March the 9th was a notable day in our history, with Congress eagerly accepting the President's recommendation. By a vote of 73-7, the United States Senate hastened to pass the President's banking measure. It was the most emphatic vote of confidence which that body had given to the head of the nation in many a long year. In the House, the new Speaker, white-haired Henry W. Rainey of Illinois, was at the throttle and running the legislative locomotive in the direction of his party leader, the President, was demanding it should go. Rainey knew it was no time for quibbling. Straight through, he drove the Roosevelt measures. Intense interest was shown in the House as the clerk read the President's great economy bill, which planned the saving of $500 million.
This Emergency Banking Act was passed during an extraordinary session of Congress. Here's how an official FDIC history describes it. Quote, "Few members of Congress knew what was contained in the administration's bill when they convened an extraordinary session at noon on March 9th. In fact, Henry Stiegel, chairman of the Committee on Banking and Currency, purportedly had the only copy of the bill in the House. Waving the copy over his head, Stiegel had entered the House chamber shouting, 'Here's the bill, let's pass it.' After only 40 minutes of debate, during which time no amendments were permitted, the House passed the bill, known as the Emergency Banking Act. Several hours later, the Senate also approved the emergency legislation intact." Close quote. The new law required that the Fed and Treasury approve each member bank before it reopened from the banking holiday. This stamp of approval from the Fed and Treasury was helpful, but it wasn't enough. The new deposit insurance would be critical to rebuilding the confidence in the system. Despite a feeling that a national deposit insurance program was necessary, its success was not guaranteed. Some argued that since the various state deposit insurance programs didn't work, a national program wouldn't either. Others argued the program would encourage bankers to take more risks because they knew their liabilities were insured. This is called moral hazard. Still, others took opposition to the idea simply because it would represent a larger federal government. Those arguments would fade with time. Today, there are few that hold these stark opposing views. The Banking Act of 1933 amended Section 12B of the Federal Reserve Act. The amendment created a new entity called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or more commonly known by its acronym, the FDIC. In the initial bill, it was set as a temporary measure that would cover up to $2,500 in deposits for banks that were members of the Federal Reserve System. By the end of 1934, total deposits had increased by 22%. This was a sign it was working. Despite the Depression's continuation, people were putting their money back in the banking system. And of all the deposits in commercial banks, 98% of them were insured. Another banking act in 1935 distanced the Deposit Insurance Fund from the Federal Reserve by not requiring the smaller institutions to become Fed members in order to participate in the insurance. In 1939, all banks, no matter their size or Fed membership, were given full access to the insurance, and the coverage was increased to $5,000. Economics is based on the principle that people react to incentives and emotions. Deposit insurance and the existence of a lender of last resort work in tandem to decrease the incentives for people to pull their money out of banks and start a bank run. They also remove some of the fear in bank panics. Here is how then Vice President George H.W. Bush put it at an event marking the 50th anniversary of the FDIC.
We see the role of the FDIC as a confidence builder, a real system that guarantees safety and security to every citizen in this country.
We'll conclude today's show with a clip from FDR, possibly his most famous and enduring quote, that came from his first inaugural address given a week before the radio fireside chat with which we started the show.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive, and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
The Lender of Last Resort Authority, along with its sister policy deposit insurance, serve as contras to that fear itself. Their sole existence can prevent panics. It's not always enough. In the Great Depression, the Fed failed to use both its existing and new Lending of Last Resort Authority. In order for them to work, businesses and people have to trust that the Last Resort Authority and the deposit insurance will be implemented effectively. All of that said, sometimes institutions get to be so large that the consequence of their collapse goes beyond just their depositors or borrowers. In the next episode of our series, we tell the story of the original institution that was too big to fail. Today's episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Alexander Badgett. Additional voice acting from Alejandra, Jackie, and Heather Nygaard. A full transcript with links to all of the sources used and quoted in today's episode can be found at www.centralverse.org. While you're there, check out the interactive graphics describing how modern central banks work today. The theme song for this season is Land of the Retro Ones by Rage. I tweet under the name Caleb Nygaard. Central banks affect the daily lives of all of us. Rate the podcast wherever you're listening. Then share it with your coworkers, classmates, family, and friends. Until next time, thanks for listening.